you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. He returns to discuss an article he wrote, Jewish Fables. It's a review or a critique of Yuval Noah Harari's Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Of course, Dr. Jones is a historian, writer, and editor of Culture Wars magazine. Among his many books are The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on the Modern History, The Slaughter of Cities, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury, The Broken Pump in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere and the Collapse of Development Economics, and of course a book that I'm reading now, which is now back in print, is John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution. So I'm enjoying that book right now. Dr. Jones, how are you doing this evening?
Just great, Tim.
Great. Listen, well, thanks for coming back on the show. Of course, Culture Wars magazine, you can purchase those books at culturewars.com and also a subscription to the magazine at culturewars.com. So this article you penned, I guess you slogged through this book, and it's a fascinating critique of Mr. Harari's work. And you introduced the article about discussing meta-history. And what exactly is meta-history, and what does it have to do with his work, with his book?
Well, I guess the father of meta history is Hegel. Well, no, wait a minute. Let me back up here.
Okay.
I'm involved in a project right now, a big project, and the name of the project is The History of Logos and the Logos of History.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so the first part is discovering mankind struggling to come to some understanding of rationality. This is a long, wearisome struggle that began when the first man spoke to the first other person, which we believe was a woman, because that's what logos is in its most fundamental understanding. It's speech. And human beings are the only creatures that can speak to each other. Okay. And at the beginning, so what you have here is the beginning of this enormous cosmic process. That by the time of Christianity, you have a clear sense that history has meaning, has a purpose. Christianity got it from both the Hebrews and the Greeks. The Greeks had a philosophy without history, and the Hebrews had a history without philosophy. And when Christianity, they came together. And for the first time, you have the sense that Logos has a history and that we can understand the entire meaning of human history from beginning to end. Now, this is the tradition that Harari is working with. But he doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, in so many ways, this man is completely clueless about what he's doing. So where did you get this idea of metahistory? Well, he's not telling us. He's just not telling us. And what he has is basically something that refutes his very attempt to do it. What I'm saying, what he has is, what is Harari? He's a Jew, he's a homosexual, and he was educated at Cambridge. Okay, Jesus College. Okay, now, as a Jew, he can't draw on anything. The Jewish text is the Talmud. According to the father of Jewish historiography, Heinrich Graetz, the only thing the Talmud is good for is teaching Jews how to cheat people. That's not my statement. If I say it, I'm called an anti-Semite. But Heinrich Graetz said it. Okay? He should know. Okay? You can't do anything. The Talmud is anti-Logos. So you can't do anything with it. So what he has to do is come up with something based on something else. His metahistory has to be based on something else. And that something else is called science. Or what it really is. Every time I say science, my hands go up and I make those quotation marks, okay? What it really is the – you can't see this on radio, but I'm making them right now. What it really is the English ideology. And the English ideology began in earnest. You could say, okay, it began with William of Ockham maybe, but it really began in earnest with Isaac Newton, who basically took a pagan cosmology and redid it as physics. You can't get there from here, okay? You can't write a meta-history based on Newtonian physics because Newtonian physics is anti-history. There is no history of balls whizzing around in circles. That's the antithesis of history. It's the same thing over and over and over again, whether you call the balls atoms or whether you call the balls planets. It's always the same thing over and over again. So you can't come up with a meta history or any history based on physics. And this is precisely what Harari is trying to do.
So yeah, physics can only explain the natural world, the natural laws, but doesn't explain the origin of the natural order. It's how it got created, how it got started.
And right, yeah, right.
And it gets into this, we talked about this a couple of interviews ago, atoms formed. You know, right?
Well, look, wait a minute. This is not coincidence. This is all they have.
Yeah.
Whether it's Dawkins, whether it's Hitchens, whether it's Harari, this is what you learn when you go to Cambridge. Atoms formed. Well, that's we said this before. I hate to beat a dead horse here, Tim, but that's all I'm getting. That's all I have to beat here. It's basically this is the only the English ideology is a one trick pony. This is the only thing they know how to say. And they all are so completely blind to the fact that they all have to begin with something that makes no sense. Okay? That makes no sense to say atoms formed. You know, I've said it before. There was a bumper sticker that said shit happens. That's the same. This is like the scientific equivalent of saying that shit happens. It can't work. It doesn't work. And all of these people, to a man, are blind to the fact that they're making fools out of themselves. Because when they're talking about physics, what they should be talking about is metaphysics. The word metaphysics has never passed across these people's lips. They don't even know it exists. It probably hasn't been taught at Cambridge since the time of William of Ockham. They are so blinded by this thing called the English ideology. And the fact of the matter is that these books are proliferating. I mean, you can't go anywhere now, apparently, without some Englishman or some Jew boy explaining the whole world to you. Because the whole world is collapsing around them and they don't know it. I guess they're trying to shore up something to make us all believe in something that nobody believes in anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, when you say something like atoms formed or energy, matter and energy appear or appeared, or shit happens. It's an observation, but doesn't have much by way of explanatory power.
It has nothing. It's so obvious. And I'm saying, as I said, I think I said, I forgive me for repeating myself, but it's Harari's fault, not my fault. Okay. I think I said the last time that when I was in India, that the Nehru Science Museum begins with Adam's form because they got it from the English. The English conquered them, and the Indians are now internalizing the commands of their oppressors. They kicked out, Gandhi kicked out the English, but the English ideology is still there ruling the Indian mind. And it's not just India, it's the entire world, okay? Because the entire world believes in science, and science, for whatever it is not metaphysics. It may be physics, and so you have the spectacle of Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, making an ass out of himself in public. Like, this is what Englishmen do these days, by saying that there was anti-time before time. What does that mean? What are you talking about? You mean BC? No, that's not what you mean, is it? Well, but you can't have – let's get this straight here. If it's a beginning – there is nothing before the beginning, because that's what a beginning is, no matter what you're talking about. So the beginning of the sight, okay, whatever it is, there's no sight before that, because that's what a beginning is, okay? So there can't be anything before the beginning. And so time cannot exist before the beginning. I mean, this is so elemental. Aristotle said that time is the number of motion. Well, if there's no motion, there's no time. Okay, what is before time or outside of time? It's eternity. Who lives in eternity? Well, God does. And so we're back at this fundamental issue here. If you're going to talk about beginning, you have to talk about creation. And if you're going to talk about creation, you've got to talk about God. Now, this is not faith. This is reason. Harari tries to convince us that it's some... because he's a Jew and he has this animus against Christianity, he tries to downplay or ridicule anybody, especially Catholics. That comes across in this book a lot. Catholics believe in weird shit like faith. No, this isn't faith. This is reason. You don't have to accept anything other than your own reason when you're talking about this type of thing. But you have to understand that there's a science called metaphysics, and physics is not metaphysics. And apparently you didn't learn that at Jesus College, and you didn't learn it at Hebrew University, and you don't know it, and you're an ignoramus, and you don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, because it's this basic logic that something cannot come from nothing.
Absolutely. Now, I, in this instance, I am now, as we're speaking, I'm in the middle of the chapter on the pre-Socratics. The main pre-Socratic was Parmenides. Well, what did he say? That which is cannot come from that which is not. That was a fundamental leap forward in consciousness in the human race. One of the greatest leaps forward in the human race, because he started articulating basically the difference between being and non-being in an abstract form, as opposed to, say, poetry of the sort that you would read in Hesiod and Homer, where the beginning was chaos, because I don't know what happened, and I don't have the powers of abstraction that come with metaphysics, so I have to come up with myths. No, this was a great leap forward, and Harari doesn't know a thing about it. I'm sorry, fella. You're way out of your depth. I mean, just as an aside here, Harari and Thomas Friedman are now having a dual lecture in London this weekend. This is pathetic. This is pathetic, but that's the world we live in.
Well, these are these, propped up public intellectuals that were forced to.
Guess what? They are propped up, because this is the rule. This is the way the oligarchs rule over us, by having us internalize their commands as our oppressors. That's why these people earn the money that they earn. They are there to subjugate the rest of us. And of course, that brings us to that part in the book where he says there's no such thing as justice. Give me a break, will you? I mean, at least Thrasymachus would say there was something as justice. When he talked to Socrates, he said it's the opinion of the powerful. At least he admitted there was something there. Well, okay, so Professor Harari believes in atoms. He believes that atoms formed, which is a total preposterous fiction, but he doesn't believe in justice. Ah. Well, guess whose interest that serves?
Well, the powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so the universe turns out to look like a lot like Gaza and the West Bank.
Rationalizes a lot, doesn't it? Justify.
It certainly does.
Can't say justify, it rationalizes.
So if there's no justice in this world, well, I guess these Jews from Poland could show up and take all that land from the Palestinians. And they don't have a leg to stand on, do they? Because there's no justice. Well, obviously, anybody who tells you there's no justice is either a fool or a knave. Does Mr. Harari have any property? If I were to break into his house and take his property, would he call the cops? And if he called the cops, why did he do that? Because he was outraged at the injustice of theft. So this is preposterous. This is the type of crap that only can be learned at universities. No normal person would say anything this preposterous.
Then he kind of gets, as you say in your article, there's some consequences to this philosophy. One thing is he immediately falls into atheism because there's no order to the universe to justify the sort of, the world we live in where there's no justice and might makes right and the oligarchs can rule, and so they pay him well to spread this belief system, I suppose, this vision of things. But he denies things like the existence of justice, of liberty, because these aren't physical things, apparently. But yet again, it's because you can't touch something doesn't mean it's not real, because ideas are real, right? I mean, they indeed have consequences.
Now we're up at the fundamental contradiction in this whole book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you said that ideas are not real. Well, wait a minute. Is that an idea?
Yeah. Then why am I reading this book then? Yeah.
Is that an idea? I can't touch it. Can I? I can't touch it. So it must not be real. Well, if the idea that ideas are not real is not real, then why am I listening to you? This is preposterous. This is ridiculous. It's time we finally lower the curtain on this charade, this obscene charade. They've gone way too far. This is preposterous. This is God moving in history. And the fact that he's spreading this book throughout supermarkets in Great Britain means that we have the tools now to basically say, okay, it's over, fella. It's over. We will not go along with this preposterous charade anymore. It's over. You're not smart. You're stupid. And I'm not saying this based on faith or anything else. I'm saying it because you don't know what you're talking about.
Now, he embraces Darwinism, of course, to justify this view, to make it give it the earlier or the air of science to it. But you talk about how. Basic things distinguishing human beings from the animal kingdom, you bring up language, which is an expression of logos, or at least logos isn't possible without language in your article. And you talk about this sort of, I remember this in the late 70s and 80s, this sort of fad of trying to make animals talk or appear they were talking.
Do you remember Washu, the talking monkey?
Yes, it was always, to me, it always seemed like some sort of carnival show, but I never quite had faith in it. But the idea that, you know, animals could talk. But actually, well, I'll let you explain that. Just the importance of language and how it distinguishes humanity from the animal world.
Well, language is the fundamental meaning of logos. It is the ground floor. It is the foundation of logos. Okay. the fact that we can speak to each other. Have you ever think how amazing this is? That I'm making noises with my mouth, staring at a blank screen, almost a well, it's got your picture of your handsome face there, okay? But I'm blabbing like this, and you're reacting to my blabbing. It's amazing. It is simply amazing. There's a story about the Jesuits among the Indians in North America.
It just happens. Come on.
All right, let's get to that. Let's forget about the Jesuits at this point. How? Let's go to the Harari explanation of how it happened. Now, what we're talking about here is fundamental, because what we're talking about here is the beginning of the human race. When did the human race begin? It began when one man, one human being, talked to another human being. That is the beginning of the human race. Okay? Now, we have all kinds of stories, all kinds of picture fables about, you know, like 2001, A Space Odyssey. Do you remember that?
Yes.
You probably smoked dope and watched that movie, you know, where there's because the only way it made sense is if you smoked dope and watched it. But anyway, where these monkeys are standing, suddenly they throw a bone up in the air and they're ba ba ba, and then we have the Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra in the background. Well, what's that mean? What I couldn't figure it out then, I can't figure it out now. We have all these fables that distract us from what has to be the fundamental fact, which is what I just said, that the human race began when one human being talked to another human being, and that human being responded, understood what was said, and responded. Now, let's take this from an evolutionary point of view. Now, what are the odds, okay, that because of natural selection or genetic modification, that two people completely independently have the same genetic modification or the same natural selection process, so that at exactly the same time, one of them says, "Hello, how are you?" And the other one says, "I'm fine, thank you." Now, that language had to evolve too. How did that language evolve? Because that had to happen all at once. There was no possible if you want to say it's evolution, I'll say, what are the odds here? What are the odds that that's going to happen? It's preposterous. It can't happen. But it had to happen because that's what we're doing right now. And that's what it means to be a human being. And so the only logical conclusion we can draw is that these human beings came into existence at that moment. Well, there was no camera around then. This is beyond history. This is I quote Pope Benedict in this regard. This is something that is beyond history, but we know it is necessary, and we know that it had to happen. So we're in the realm once again of metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a beginning. Now, the only way this can happen, the only plausible explanation, is creation, which is parallel to the fundamental fact of the creation of everything. Now, if you say, as you have to say, that God created the heavens and the earth, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the first sentence of Genesis. It's the only possible metaphysical explanation of everything, of anything. You have to say that. It's a metaphysical statement. It's not something that can be, you have to have faith to believe. It's a purely metaphysical statement. Now, if that happened, God could have programmed into this universe some type of process. Because we have a creator now, and the creator is omnipotent, and he can do this however he damn well pleases. Okay? So at this point, we immediately eliminate anything problematic about evolution. The only thing problematic about evolution is atheism. Once you have atheism, you have one insoluble problem after another, leading to all sorts of contradictions of the sort that this man puts in his book. Once you have God at the beginning, which you have to have, which is logically necessary if we're talking about a beginning, well, then he can have a plan for creation that will evolve in some way or other. Certainly, that's possible, because there's evidence of this in nature. If we look at the acorn, there's a plan in the acorn that evolves into an oak. Okay, how did that plan get there? Well, God put it there, because this is part of creation and God is responsible for creation. So at this point, we eliminate every single problem, because every single problem that we're talking about is a function of atheism. That's the fundamental problem.
And these contradictions, I think he's aware of, because he, at least according, I haven't read the book, I'm basing it on your article, your critique, but he tries to obscure, as you say, he tries to obscure the boundaries separating animal communication from human speech, kind of equating the two. Of course, there's a fundamental difference. You know, these are, it's learned response. It's, you know, that these chimpanzees were doing, and it was more or less just an elaborate carnival show. And you say that the fact that the felicity in which children learn language, and the fact that the laborious effort has to be done to make animals mimic human communication, is proof that there's something fundamentally different between, you know, the two worlds, the animal world and the human world. But he's trying to come up with a materialist explanation, and the Darwinian gradualist approach is the only way he can do that. But the only problem is that model doesn't fit into reality. So he distorts, he cuts the reality into pieces on its Procrustean bed to fit the idea.
The only reason we take the idea of animals talking seriously, other than Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse, and all this other type of stuff, is the fact that it's kind of required by the Darwinist ideology.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, everything is gradual, and so you take these similarities. Apes do kind of look like human beings compared to butterflies. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
So therefore, well, what do you mean therefore? No, there's no therefore here. There's no, you're the one who's proposing this, therefore, and you're proposing, well, there had to be some type of intermediary step, the missing link, all this type of stuff, which we still haven't found. That cannot exist. That cannot happen. The whole point that I'm trying to make here in this book is that there are beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
There are beginnings. And because it's a beginning, what went before it did not exist. It did not exist at a certain point. At a certain point, it did exist, and that's what a beginning is. So whether you're talking about the entire universe or the human race or whatever it is, there was a beginning. Okay?
And what he does here with sort of this genetic or Darwinian explanation, I've heard this argument before about explanation of morality. They come up with things like a selfish gene and altruistic gene and these things. They're reducing morality to sort of biological determinism. And then, of course, inevitably this comes up. So if there's no truth, there's no objective right or wrong. Immediately this is used to once again, science is invoked to ratify the sexual revolution and proclaim that there's no sexual morality, because it's all construct, it's all based on myths and not based on a natural order. Morality doesn't reflect a natural order because there is no natural order, right?
Right, right. So this is where we get to the really funny part of Harari's book. I mean, it's funny to begin with, but it really gets funny here. So okay, we're sitting in Professor Harari's class, and we're the stupid goyim who are sitting at his feet trying to figure out. So I finally get it. I think I got it, Professor. I'm going to raise my hand. I think I got it. So everything's biology, right? Right, Professor? I mean, like my Catholic faith. You know, that's all just kind of biological epiphenomenon. Isn't that right? So basically then it comes down to everything is biology. So that means, well, we're kind of male and female, right? That's biology, isn't it? Well, no, I got it completely wrong, because when it comes to male and female, that's all social constructs. Well, wait a minute. I'm confused, Professor, because I guess it's because I'm stupid, but there's another possibility that you're completely incoherent. The one area where it does seem to be that there is a biological statement that we can all agree upon, you reject it. Now, at this point, we're shifting from Harari the Jew, who's at war with Logos, to Harari the homosexual, who is now at war with nature. a biological nature because of his sexual preferences. In both instances, what we're seeing here is the complete disruption of intellectual life, of rationality, because of the lifestyle choices that this man has made.
Yes, he's obviously his analysis might be skewed based on his own personal preferences or disordered sexuality. You said, I think this is a quote of his, and this is telling, because this is supposedly a science book, correct? A science book. And he writes, the frequent infidelities that characterize modern marriages and the high rates of divorce, not to mention the cornucopia of psychological complexes from which both children and adults suffer, all result from forcing humans to live in nuclear families and monogamous relationships that are incompatible with our biological software. So basically, if we all just behave like homosexuals, meaningless.
why has the human race been so stupid? We had to wait till Professor Harari showed on the scene to figure this out. Wait a minute. Aren't you a Darwinist, Professor Harari? Isn't the whole point of Darwinism this big struggle to transmit your genes to the next generation? Well, wait a minute. How can you be a homosexual and a Darwinist then? Mm-hmm. You failed. You're losing in the struggle of spreading your DNA. Your DNA is completely worthless because of the sexual choices you have made. Again, we have this contradiction here. I'm confused, Professor Harari.
Yeah, how does that factor into the survival of the fittest? I mean, really?
How do you survive?
How
do you survive as a homosexual? I mean, in the long run, we're all dead, aren't we? Well, if you're a homosexual, you are. That was John Maynard Keynes, who should have known he was a homosexual.
Yeah.
He was childless, and so in the long run, he was dead.
Yeah.
But the rest of it, let's put it this way. We are human beings, and each of us is completely unique because we have a completely unique soul and so on and so forth. So we're irreplaceable. But a rabbit, there's no personality to a rabbit. The rabbit is the same as the species. And all this rabbit does is pass the DNA on to the next species, right? The species is encompassed. That's the personality that the rabbit has. He has no individual personality. He's a function of these mechanisms that are programmed into him by God, okay? So the whole point of being a rabbit is to basically transmit your rabbit genes to the next generation of rabbits. Well, you can only do that because of sexual difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just told us here that sexual difference doesn't have any meaning. Because is that based on reality? No, but it's based on your life, buddy, because you're a homosexual and you're living a completely delusionary life. Because of that complete narcissistic delusion fostered by the Jewish power structure that promotes you as some type of deep thinker, you know, completely blinded to your own futility and stupidity. That's what you are.
And, of course, then he cites, swinging cavemen to justify.
Yeah, I saw that. Was that the Flintstones? Was that like the X-rated version of the Flintstones?
So, basically, I mean, that's like he's just mimicking Margaret Mead here with her, you know, Blue Lagoon anthropology, right? It's just justifying. There's no basis for this. And, you know, and of course, Margaret Mead's own studies, that's to justify her own life. But again, all that dubious science and anthropology was directed at the American population to usher in the sexual revolution. It's all nonsense.
Yeah, this is an old book. I wrote that book almost 30 years ago now.
Yeah.
It's called Degenerate Moderns, and the first chapter is on Margaret Mead.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Samoa and discovered that they don't take sex seriously. And adultery is not a crime or a sin in Samoa. Well, it turns out that it is, and they beat each other up, and it's just the same old story.
Yep.
But she happened to commit adultery before she went there. So everything's jaundiced to the yellow eye, and she projected this on to the poor Samoans, who had to wait until Derek Freeman showed up and said wasn't the case, an Australian. Okay, but the powers that be under Franz Boas loved the story, and it became a textbook. I don't know, maybe it was a textbook when I was in college.
Yeah, and it's the same way that, that Alfred Kinsey was promoted, and it's the same thing, invoking science to bring on the rush, the sexual revolution, and to rationalize or to find a scientific basis for degenerate, unnatural behavior.
Yeah. So you got two factors here. You got the individual who is burdened with guilt because he committed a sin, and then you got the oligarch who promotes this guy or girl because it's useful to what the world order that they want to impose on the rest of us. And believe me, the most useful thing you can say, I'm saying that to all these people who want to be successes in academia. The most useful thing you can say when it comes to the oligarchs is that there is no such thing as justice, which means you just better reconcile yourself to the will of the oligarchs and do what they tell you to do. Now, they're very kind, okay? They'll give you all the pornography you want to watch, and they'll lend you money, which you can spend, and all this other type of stuff. But basically, you got to reconcile yourself to doing the will of the powerful. That is the message of anyone who tells you there's no morality or no justice.
Yes, as you say, when right and wrong becomes the opinions of the powerful, those who lack political power have no way to formulate their objections, much less implement them. When Dawkins makes human behavior a function of selfish genes, he appeals to the guilty conscience of those who are burdened by their own transgressions of the moral law by absolving them of responsibility. But the whole English system is there to reject the idea of morality, of meaning to the universe, so to justify their predation. And you get into this thing about morality itself and reason, and you cite Immanuel Kant, which is his idea. I guess his was the categorical imperative. Now this whole idea of the idea of morality isn't just a construct, right? I mean, notions of morality or ideas of morality. Reflect the natural order, what things we can observe for the natural order, and from there we get our moral laws or rules. Correct, as opposed to
everything I'm saying here goes against the fundamental premise of modern philosophy, and I'm going to attribute that to René Descartes, who said that there was the res cogitans, which was the mind. And there's the res extensa, which is the universe. And there's this unbridgeable chasm between them. He couldn't figure out how they were connected. He said, well, I guess it's the pineal gland. This is the legacy that he bequeathed to the West. This is not the origin of the concept of logos. Logos is common to both the mind and the universe. Mathematics is an example of a purely rational structure created by the mind, okay, that can explain the universe. Well, how can you do that? You can have describe the characteristics of every single possible circle without ever having seen a circle in nature, because there is no such thing as a perfect circle in nature. The mind has abstracted from nature and come up with this explanation. Which shows the consonance. The whole point I'm trying to make here is that there is a consonance between the human mind and the universe in which it finds itself. And where does that come from? Well, it comes from God, because both of these things are manifestations of the mind of God.
Now, in promoting
the characteristic of God is logos. And it was the human history took that leap forward when St. John wrote his gospel. St. John said, in the beginning, there was logos. Now, he's taking as his model the first sentence in Genesis. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Well, this is thousands of years later. And now he's saying, in the beginning, there was logos. Now, that links up Hebrew scripture and Greek philosophy. And then he takes it a step further, and then he says, and logos is God, and God is logos. Well, that's a stunning type of statement. And then he says God is love, which is even more complicated. I'll get into that later, okay? But I'm saying the point here is that there is no radical disparity between the mind and the universe. And so he solves the problems Plato was a genius, and he understood that what I said about the circle, there is a form, he said, called the circle. There is an eidos, a form. Okay? It doesn't exist in nature. He was right. Okay? So where does it exist? This is what Aristotle said to Plato. Well, where is it? Well, Plato didn't know, because he didn't have an understanding of God, the complexity of God, because now we know. We know where that form is. It's in the mind of God. All of this is in the mind of God. Okay? And that explains why I can say, okay, there's no radical dichotomy between the res cogitans and the res extensa. This is all a manifestation of the divine logos. There's no radical discontinuity here. So problem solved, as Inspector Clouseau would say, okay? The modern problem has now been solved, okay? We can move on.
But this world, nevertheless, he promotes this worldview, this Jewish or English worldview of scientism, materialism, and he promises to bring forth utopia with this. And this seems to be a running theme, right?
We're back to the Jewish revolutionary spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The Jew rejects Logos. He builds his life on a rejection of Logos, and then he's always telling us he's going to create heaven on earth. Let me get this straight, okay? You don't believe in Logos, but you're going to create as this perfect order, world order. Based on what? On what? Your rejection of Logos, your say-so, chutzpah, whatever it is. So we have a communism. There's a good example. That was heaven on earth, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Zionism, another heaven on earth for the Jews anyway, not for the Palestinians. So how is Professor Harari going to create heaven on earth?
Well, he says it's freedom, the market, capitalism, coupled with sort of this blind materialism, right?
Yeah, good luck on that one. We live in heaven already, right? We got all that stuff now. But he gets much more specific, okay? And when he starts to talk about happiness.
Yes, that was fascinating, because this article took a turn which I did not expect, which was really fascinating regarding about happiness, the source of happiness, and apparently it's all a matter of pharmacology, which is really, disturbing.
Not disturbing, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so happiness. So here we are, after telling us that the cognitive revolution is about mankind and that's abandoning materialism there. He jumps back on the materialist horse at the end of the book and he says, happiness is basically chemicals in your brain. Well, we're back in the 60s. Wait a minute, professor. We tried this already. This is not new. Okay? This was turn on, drop out. Okay, Timothy Leary had the secret chemical that was going to give you a complete enlightenment, okay, or complete delusion. So, okay, it's not LSD, okay, we've at least made progress in that regard. So what is it?
It's like, now it's what? It's oxycontin and...
Oxycontin, yeah. Yes. Oh, we're great. So here he is, the genius Jew boy from Jerusalem, okay, who now announces that it's all chemicals in your brain and all you have to do is change the chemicals. And he announces this in the middle of the opioid epidemic. I mean, talk about perfect timing. Perfect timing here. Okay, we have all these people thanks to the Sackler family. Now, wait a minute. The Sackler family are the people that created OxyContin. They are the people who created the opioid epidemic. Heroin is cheaper than OxyContin now. We got all this dope flooding into places like northern Indiana, LaPorte, people dropping dead of overdoses on a daily basis, okay, because of the Sackler family. Because these are people, we can actually give a description of an innocent opioid addiction. Football players get injured. They go to the doctor, and the doctor has been primed to push OxyContin by free trips to Cancun sponsored by the Sackler family. They don't do that anymore, they say, but they did. Okay, so we'll give this kid who has a football injury, we'll give him OxyContin and we'll hook him on opiates. And at a certain point, he gets addicted and his habit goes up and he starts. And in the meantime, in order to maintain the permit on this, the exclusive permit, the Sackler family souped up their OxyContin by making it 8 times more powerful than it was originally. So now you can get a real high by chopping it up and shooting it into your veins. But you got started innocently. I'm giving these people the benefit of the doubt because you began with a football injury and then you got addicted to opiates and suddenly heroin was cheaper than opiates and now you're a heroin addict. This is all laid at the feet of the Sackler family, who were one of the biggest contributors to medical schools in Jerusalem, in Israel. So wait a minute. Now we have this guy. Not only is he a shill for the rich and the powerful by telling us there's no justice, it turns out he's a shill for the Sackler family. He's a shill for drug dealers. I mean, this is pretty low. Yeah. I mean, why is this man being promoted as someone we should look up to? Do we look up to drug dealers now? Well, yes, if they're Jews and they donate money and call it philanthropy after addicting all these people in this country. Well, yeah, we do. As a matter of fact, and we have people like Professor Harari giving them some type of philosophical legitimacy. This is shameful.
Yeah, the Sacklers are like you say, that it's similar to Mo Dalitz, where he becomes a philanthropist after being
exactly. It's exactly the same thing. I don't think they gave money to the ADL. I'm sure they gave ADL, but this is the way people like Mo Dalitz bought respectability. Mo Dalitz gives $100,000 to the ADL, and from that point on, anyone who says he's a criminal is an anti-Semite. That happened in 1984.
Mm-hmm. And you had a good turn of phrase here. You're turning Karl Marx upside down. Professor Harari feels that the opiate should be the religion of the masses. That's how you find happiness. The answer to life is through drugs.
That's right. I have to admit, I was very clever there with turning Karl Marx upside down. He said religion is the opiate of the masses, and now Harari is saying opium is the religion of the masses. Yes.
I mean, it is funny.
I hope
you have this, this Jewish-English view being promoted. There's always been a link between, it's British philo-Semitism and these things. But, I think you referred to it in the article. This is very similar what they're doing to society, making everyone addicted to drugs. This is also very similar to Aldous Huxley's vision, which you cite in the article in Brave New World. But it's very much like the opium wars, correct? I mean,
The English were involved in big drug dealers from throughout the 19th century. Mm-hmm. The English, this insatiable desire for tea. And they had a chronic balance of payments problem with China. And so they figured, well, we'll grow opium in India and then we'll sell it to the Chinese, get them addicted, and that'll solve our balance of payments problem. And that led to the opium wars in China. So it's shameful. Not only that, it's the same the English DNA in America, the Boston Brahmins, a lot of them made their families from the dope opium trade.
But
it's not exactly a venerable history, but it's a history. And now we have a man who's promoting it again as something legit here. This is ridiculous. Why? How stupid do they think we are?
Hmm. And it's the based on the, I guess, the Newtonian view of things, the British view of things, it's rationalized just by by the balance of payments, the price structure. Right? I mean, it's the market working.
So we as good Americans, we inherit everything bad from England. Okay, so now we are involved. The United States of America is involved in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Now, what is Afghanistan famous for?
Well, I don't think it's pistachios.
What is the only product that Afghanistan can produce as an export product?
Opium, the poppy
opium seed. Poppies. Yeah. It just grows natural there. Mm-hmm. It's just a natural, the native species to Afghanistan. So it turns out that we were involved in Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion. Zbigniew Brzezinski bragged about how he lured the Soviets into Afghanistan, and then we weaponized the Mujahideen and we drove them out. And then there's chaos, and then finally the Taliban takes over Afghanistan in the aftermath. And the Taliban put an end to the opium trade,
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan. So then 9/11 happens. And for some reason, they decided that it was Afghanistan that did it. Okay, so this justifies the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. And guess what happens after the Americans invade Afghanistan?
Well, the opium crops recover.
Wait a minute. This is miraculous here.
Yes.
Suddenly, every year after the Americans come to Afghanistan, the opium production goes up and up and up.
Well, Dr. Jones, you of all people should believe in miracles.
This is not. There's nothing miraculous about it. it's just simple cause and effect here.
Yes.
Americans arrive, opium production increases. It's cause and effect here. And so our illustrious gay mayor, just after he's elected, he just up and leaves, up and leaves South Bend for 9 months. He's in the Navy. So where does he sail to? He sails to the coast of Afghanistan. Well, wait a minute. Afghanistan. What's the biggest port in Afghanistan? Well, wait a minute. There is no coast. What's the Navy doing in Afghanistan? Okay, well, this is what the newspaper said. He's there to deal with terrorism, money laundering, and the drug trade. So he comes back like a war hero. He's like a war hero now because he's been anointed, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
I confront him. He gives a speech, and I confront him, and I said, look, these are the facts. Opium production has increased every year that the Americans have been there. It seems to me an inescapable conclusion that the Americans are protecting or fostering the opium trade. He said, that's a conspiracy. You're a conspiracy nut. I said, well, what's the plausible explanation then? I said, we know that the CIA was involved in the heroin trade in the Burma Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
No more. We know that's a fact. So what he says to me is, well, I wasn't alive then, and he walks away.
Well, you see, you're asking difficult questions. What you should say is thank you for your service.
Yeah,
like a good American, right?
Like a good American. I don't know. I just have this tendency to ask the wrong question.
Yeah. Yeah, it just seems to be every time there's some sort of undeclared war that the CIA or the Pentagon are fighting or waging, there seems to be a brisk drug trade in that area, right? Whether it's Central America, Vietnam.
Well, so wait a minute. So where is all this? 93% of the opium in the world comes from Afghanistan. Well, we're in charge of Afghanistan. The Taliban put an end to opium production. Well, what did they have compared to the resources that the United States has? And the United States can't seem to put an end to it? Well, I'm sorry, I don't believe it. I mean, you put the facts together and you have to say, well, America must be promoting the opium trade. You know, they are responsible for the people dying in La Porte, Indiana.
I don't know how they get it here. It's amazing. They have incredible distribution networks.
Yes.
The Pashtuns in Afghanistan.
I don't know. I mean, I think it goes basically all those trucks that go in with military material from the port in Pakistan all go back full of heroin. Of course, it's just me trying to be logical about what's going on. These are stories I've heard. But it's one of those things where how are we going to find this out? Maybe you should go over there and check it out.
Well, it's the same way they came back on bodies of servicemen during the Vietnam War, Air America, all these all these proprietary airlines that are fronts for the CIA, or various banks that they established throughout the years, Castle Bank, Nugenhan Bank, the BCCI Bank, for Pete's sake.
Right.
I don't know, Resorts International, Mary Carter Paint Company, casinos, Las Vegas.
They're great for laundering money.
Yeah, yeah. So.
They're great for laundering money.
Yeah.
And so what we have here is a system that is corrupt from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. And here's a man who's trying to justify it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't work. I mean, when are we going to put an end to this? Or do we have to go on forever listening to Englishmen and Jews making asses out of themselves in public by telling things, giving us stories, fables that are completely preposterous?
Yeah, it is preposterous. It really is.
You're providing a public service to the universe here by exposing all of this preposterous stuff. Eventually, the truth is great, and it will prevail, and eventually the word is going to get out.
Well, I mean, you've talked about this, and you cover it in your article here about morality and reason, by seeing the universe as an ordered system. We can, from that, we can derive morality, and through reason, if we employ reason to discover morality, we are liberated. But their strategy is to liberate us from morality, which actually leads to our enslavement.
That's right. That you can't liberate a rational creature from rationality. Okay, that's like liberating a fish from the ability to swim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not going to end up happily. So morality is practical reason. It is reason. It is reason attuned to the good, as opposed to reason attuned to the true. Okay, how do you achieve the good? The first explanation is ethics for the individual, and then it's economics for the family. And it's politics for the state. All of these things are concentric circles, and they are all based on morality. This is the patrimony of Greek philosophy. This is what Socrates is talking about when he's talking to Thrasymachus and the sophists, who believe that morality is relative and it varies from place to place. He said this cannot be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about how you can't talk about gods in the way that Homer does without corrupting the population, because that's not what God is. All of these things are all subsumed under the concept of logos. And at a certain point, the concept of logos got so powerful in Greek thought that it rejected the traditional gods. The gods were judged according to logos. And that led to a whole new world. And that's, in a sense, the topic of this book.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Now, you write here, I'm going to quote you if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all.
Because I think this is very near the end of the article. And because you're referring to the Sackler family, this very wealthy family that's, a drug dealing family, more or less, made money off pharmacology, a fortune off of it. The story of the Sackler family gives new meaning to Harari's celebration of drugs as the only source of lasting happiness. It also puts in stark relief the difference between the Jewish heaven on earth based on Darwinism, science, in quotes, libido dominandi, and dope, and St. Augustine's city of God. We now have a clear idea of the slavery which Harari's Jewish utopia entails. Can anyone in his right mind choose that over a social order based on logos as articulated by the tradition of the natural law, which was abandoned at around the same time as the scientific revolution? According to that concept, moral laws are based on human nature, on the way we are. As a consequence, morality is a function of human nature so that reason can discover valid moral principles by looking at the nature of humanity and society, no matter where on earth. This means that we are ought to do is related to what we are. You shall not kill, for instance, is based on the real value of human life and the need to preserve it. You shall not commit adultery is based on the real value of marriage. This means that the law of morality are not rules that we invent, but principles that we discover, similar in a way that the laws of science, such as physiology, just as our physiological nature makes it necessary for us to eat certain foods and to breathe oxygen for our bodies to be healthy, so our moral nature makes it certain moral rules and laws necessary for our souls to be healthy. Not only is there a physical order in nature, but also a moral order. I thought there was warranted reading. It was a great piece there in the article.
Thank you. I felt like cheering when you were reading it
because it closes out. Now, And there's, like you said, there's a as you said, there's a mysterious conformity here between the rationality of our minds and the rationality found in the world around us. The order of the universe tells us there is meaning to the universe, and that meaning is God. There is a creator, and so we can divine that, if you will. Now, you're funny, because to close this, we're coming up on an hour now, and so I don't want to take too much more of your time, but you close the article out. Well, it was kind of funny, because Professor Harari assumes the role as a serpent in the Garden of Eden. Want to talk about that in his book, near the end of his book?
Yeah, you shall be like gods.
Yeah.
That's his next book. His next book is called Homo Deus.
So we're back to that.
Well, he never got away from it. Here you have a Jew who is supposed to be a scientist, and all he's haunted by Genesis. Mm-hmm. He's haunted by the Hebrew scriptures that he's thrown overboard. Can't get away from them.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I can't get away from it. I can't accept it. So I know what I'll do. I'll become Satan. Yes. I'll become the serpent in the garden. And I'll tell people they can become like gods. And that's the title of his book, mm-hmm. Homo Deus. Well, good luck. We've tried this before.
Is there an apple on the cover?
I haven't seen the book. So he's probably mouthing off as we speak. No, it's too late now. But he probably mouthed off this weekend in London along with Thomas Friedman. I don't know. Have the English gotten really that stupid? I guess they have.
Yes.
We tried this before. It didn't work. Okay? How many times do you have to bang your head against the wall to realize that it's painful and better when you stop?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. History repeats itself, or at least it echoes, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, like animal to God. Well, like the United States of America, which went from barbarism to decadence without ever finding civilization along the way, Harari sapiens went from being an animal to a god without becoming human. Which vision is more plausible? The idea that man evolved from an amoeba into a god, or claim that at the dawn of humanity, there appeared quite suddenly and abruptly the faculties of language, rationality, morality, self-awareness, and religion all combined in an immortal soul, practically all at once. But now it should be obvious that what Harari calls intelligent design is another word for logos. The event that he predicts for the future actually happened 70,000 years ago. It is now time for sapiens to abandon the illusions of the serpent and return to being what it has been all along, the rational animal who occupies an intermediary position between angels and beasts.
Amen, brother.
That's a great way to finish out the article. Don't read any more. I don't want to read any more, because people should go out and get a subscription and read the article themselves.
Yes.
So, listen, that's a great way to close. Anything else? Any other observations? I know.
No, we've covered it all.
Yeah.
We've covered it all. We're moving on. So we'll move on, and we'll try and put this whole thing together. And then when the book comes out, we'll have another.
Yeah, certainly. That's E. Michael Jones, culturewars.com. There you can buy his books, other books there as well, and also subscribe to the magazine culturewars.com. I am right now reading the Cardinal Kroll biography, and perhaps sometime in the near future when I get through that and digest it, we can talk about that as well. That's a fascinating read.
Yeah, so, that changed my life. That book changed my life.
Very interesting about Philadelphia. It tells us so much what really went on in the 60s and 70s. So, well, listen, thanks a lot. I'll let you go. Enjoy the rest of your evening. And when I post this, it'll be next day or so, I'll send you the link.
Great. Thanks, Tim. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming on. You have a nice evening.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye. Bye.